And we are deeply grateful for them. All the material in this three-class series is in this book, and then it's also on our website free in three different issues of Reason and Revelation. The first one was published in January of this year, so you can go to our website, download those free of charge if you would like to have the information. If you were not with us for our last two sessions, we really don't have time to backtrack very far. Let me say this to you, though, very quickly. The number one explanation, I think, given in Scripture for why God allows there to be suffering in the world. Because He created the world for human beings. And He created human beings to be in this environment for a brief, temporary period of time for us to decide where we want to spend eternity. So it's our proving grounds, it's our probationary period, and the decisions that we're making every day will determine our eternal destiny. So that's why we're here. And I suggested to you that the over 7 billion people on the planet have no clue that that's why they're here. And Hindus think, you know, I'm going to recycle anyways many times, so it really doesn't matter how you live. And all of the philosophies and ideologies and religions of the world have it wrong on this. But Christians can understand God's thinking on the matter. Then we looked at some sub-causes under that. Since God created the ideal environment of veil, V-A-L-E, veil of soul-making, where we are preparing our spirits for eternity, there are a lot of things that happen in the world that can cause suffering as a result. And one of those, surely the top of the list, is sin. Our own sin, you realize much of our grief and heartache and suffering is self-inflicted. We don't really want to admit that, but a lot of times it is. When people, you see them at a point in their life where they're down and out and, you know, they're hungry or whatever their circumstances might be, but you can't see all of the decisions that they made that got them to that point. And so many times it was decisions they made. And while we want to be compassionate with each other, because we all make bad decisions, so often our suffering and our grief comes from our own decisions. And it comes from the sin of other people. Other people commit sins and hurt us. You know, somebody's drinking and driving and they careen into your car and cause you to be put in the hospital and stay there for months. You're suffering because of the sin of someone else. You say, well, why would God allow that? How can He not allow it if He's going to create an environment where everybody gets to decide where they want to spend eternity? He wants everybody to make the right choices. But given the environment and the circumstances, He must allow people to make wrong choices and create all kinds of catastrophic consequences. Do you not see that when the atheist says, well, that's proof there's no God, it's just the opposite. That's proof there is a God. A perfect, infinite God who created beings like Himself, were made in His image, who can reproduce additional beings, all of whom it's God's will, be permitted to live with Him eternally. But we all have to decide. Otherwise, God would have merely created robots. What would be the point of that? So free will beings, we exercise our volition. And that's where a lot of suffering comes from. Then we looked at a number of passages yesterday where the Bible comes right out and says, look, if you think Satan's in hell, you're mistaken. He will be consigned there in eternity. But right now, 1 Peter 5:8, he's like a roaring lion prowling around this planet. And he apparently has helpers, right? He has angels that assist him. And they are not able to do anything without God's permission. By His permissive will, He allows Satan to operate, but not through miraculous means. Even as the age of miracles passed in the first century, where God is not performing miracles, neither is Satan. You know, demon possession was part of that period of the miracle age. I don't believe that's happening anymore. Read Zechariah 13, the first 4 or 5 verses, where the unclean spirit is passed out of the land and these things are not happening. There's no need for any of that to happen. But the human mind can become sufficiently depraved where it seems like a person's possessed, but that's only because I heard a fellow say, man, you hadn't spent much time around little 2-year-olds, have you? They're demon possession. No, certain times in our lives we can act in ways that seem rather bizarre. And the further a person's mind gets away from truth and right and purity and God, the more a person can become demon-like and hateful and be able to kill without compunction. You've seen really evil, wicked people. Well, they weren't born that way, and they've not been indwelt. They lived a life and made decisions that brought them to that very unpleasant point of their lives. So he's operating, and Job, of course, is the classic case where Job experienced catastrophic suffering in his life. But remember, all of it was natural. And by that I mean circumstances occurred that nobody would put their finger on and say, oh, that's some miraculous event. No, when bad guys come and kill your servants, carry off all your livestock, that's just people. But Satan was behind that. He can work in a way, you know, it's really similar to the providence of God. The way God can work without performing a miracle, so can Satan. And any one of us can allow ourselves to be used by Satan and thereby do Satan's bidding without him actually occupying our mind and taking over our will. Remember, Peter's the classic example there, Matthew 16, was it, where he said, oh Lord, we don't want you to go to Jerusalem where you're going to be killed. And Jesus turned around and said, get behind me, Satan. You're taking his position. You're encouraging his cause. So you're doing Satan's bidding. You've become a worker for Satan, even if you did not intend to do that. That is, in fact, what you're doing. And then number three, we spent considerable time talking about how suffering and hardship can strengthen us. It can correct us when we need to be corrected. It can improve and perfect us. It can mature us spiritually and purify us and discipline us. Discipline is good. It's not a bad thing. God said, if you don't get any discipline in your life, you are an illegitimate child. An illegitimate child. You don't even have a parent. But discipline, God says, those that I love, I discipline. Proverbs 3, quoted in Hebrews chapter 12. So these are very positive things. And here are a few passages to remind you. When you and I fall into various trials and testings and temptations, count it joy. Because the testing of our faith will produce patience, and that will then continue to have spiritual impact where we will be complete spiritually and lack nothing. Romans 5, tribulation produces perseverance. So do you want to develop in your life patience and perseverance? The only way you're going to get it is to go through tribulation. We ought to be willing to do that. Here's what Paul talked about this morning. Look at how integral tribulation is into generating hope in our lives. And there's the passage from Hebrews 12 where we had human fathers who corrected us and we respected them. And yet God never makes mistakes in the discipline and corrections that he gives to us. And ultimately, if we'll submit to it and be trained by it, it will yield the peaceable fruit of righteousness in our lives. These are great passages that help us to make sense of life. The world doesn't have this. They don't have these keen insights that give us a spiritual framework. See, we can go through life and look at everything that happens through this spiritual framework, this lens that gives us stability. And the ability to weather the storms of life when other people's lives are falling apart. 1 Peter 1, greatly rejoice. Yes, we've been grieved by various trials, but the genuineness of our faith, look at that, being much more precious than gold that perishes, will ultimately result in praise, honor, and glory. We're being tested. We must go through the test and not think it's strange. When things happen to us, fiery trials, he calls them. As if something strange has happened to us. No, we're looking forward to a time when glory will be revealed, God's glory, Jesus' glory, and it will be a time of exceeding joy. And then Revelation 2:10, Satan will cast some of you into prison. This would be a good passage, you see, to use on the other one, where Satan's active. Well, in the first century, in the seven churches in Asia Minor, were Christians being grabbed by Satan, who was wearing like a red suit with pointed horns and a pitchfork and throwing them into prison? No. They were being thrown into prison by the Romans who were persecuting the Christians. So they were doing the work of Satan. Satan was active, involved in stimulating that. But notice it's so that we can be tested. Remember the rest of the verse, be faithful, even if they kill you, and you'll receive the crown of life. There's the outcome. We're not really wanting to stay here in this world indefinitely. Why would you want to do that? Even though God gives you lots of comforts and pleasures and things to enjoy, we know this world is not our home. And so it's temporary. We go through the testing and we anticipate a greater time. Remember, Eliphaz used the comparison of God being a surgeon. And I pointed out to you that God bruises but binds up, wounds but his hands make whole. That in fact, surgeons who take knives and saws and hammers and hammer and cut open the human body, all of that very barbaric, but it's all done for good. And that's what God is doing. Jesus is the great physician. And so if we look at, we subject ourselves medically to a lot of things that are not pleasant. I remember as a child when the polio vaccine was invented, and we had to go to the nearest school and get a shot. I remember as a little child thinking, they're going to stick a needle in me? And the little girl in front of me, she was doing fine until she got up there just ahead of me, and she started screaming and squalling. Well, that did it for me. I was ready to leave. You know? And then finally they put it in a sugar cube. Why didn't they do that in the first place? I don't know. But we've subjected ourselves to a lot of things like that, but it's all for our good. Children do not want to see painful things as being good. Well, the more we mature and look at what God says, the more we can see that that's the case. All of that calculated to save life. So can we not see God in the same light? Proverbs 29, parental discipline. Here's a great passage that tells us kind of the tools that parents have to discipline their children. They need to exercise both of these in a balanced way in order to have the effect that it ought to have, to make a child well-rounded and so forth. Host of passages that talk about this. Well, God is our heavenly parent. If parents are to discipline their children, the Father of our spirits surely would, to shape and mold our spirits, not only into spiritual adulthood, but to prepare us for eternity. And here's the Proverbs 3 passage. Don't despise the chastening of the Lord or detest his correction. Notice the atheist that says, well, you know, I lost my child. I don't want to have anything to do with any so-called God. Why are you despising the chastening of the Lord and detesting his correction? A father loves a son when he does that. And there's the quotation of it in Hebrews 12 that we looked at a moment ago. Let's hurry on. 1 Corinthians 10. No temptation has overtaken you except such as common to man. That is, everything that you and I experience in the way of suffering, others have gone through it before us. But God is faithful. He's not abandoning us. He's trustworthy and can be counted on to be with us through all this. He will not allow us to be tempted beyond what we are able. Notice that. Whatever you're going through in life and you think, man, there is no way I can bear up under this. Hey, if you're a faithful Christian, yes, you can. You are able to do so, and he is able to be certain that we do not go beneath what we're able to handle. And in fact, he will provide circumstances that make you able to bear it. Have you ever been in a discouraging moment of your life where people have mistreated you or whatever, and somebody out of nowhere that you least expected came and gave you encouragement? You can look back over your life and see a lot of circumstances like that. Well, God promises I'll do that. There's a way for you to not throw in the towel. If you'll be patient, wait on God, he'll work things out, and consequently you will be able to bear whatever it is you are called upon to go through. Now, ask yourself this question. Would you rather go to a party or a funeral? Come on, really? You know, a ball game? What about a corn roast? Would you rather go to a corn roast in right there? Or to a funeral in there where there's a casket sitting there? Well, all of us would say, obviously. But listen to what God says to us. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. It's better for you to go to a funeral than to a party or a ball game or something else. See, only Christians can make sense of that. Why? What good is it? What's it do to us? That enables the living to take it to heart. Sorrow is better for your spirit, it's better for your being, it's better for your life than laughter. Laughter is not sinful, But we think sorrow is negative and laughter is positive, and you want to get as much laughter and as little sorrow as possible. Well, you're not understanding spiritual things. It is by a sad countenance that the heart is made better. Do you want your spirit, your mind, your heart to be made better? That's really not accomplished that much through laughing. I mean, laughter is a good medicine. There's benefits to it, obviously, as God created it. But we don't see the house of mourning as something that's a positive thing, but it really is. You know, it's even good for children. I've known parents who don't take their child to a funeral because they don't want them to have to face death. That's not good. Let them face death. You had to face it, and they will too. Why not get them comfortable with it? You know, we're living at a time in our history because things are so accelerated in medicine, for example, that we don't have to face death like our grandparents did, where there really weren't any hospitals. The doctor came to your house and then wrote down on the cause of death, like my grandfather, a leakage of the heart, which really says nothing, because they didn't know. They figured he had heart trouble, and that's why he died. My dad was 6 years old when that happened to him, to his father. And that was life. Americans were closer to God, closer to the Christian framework. Death was more of a part of life, an illness, and they handled it better than we do now, you see. Americans have trouble facing that, and they don't want to face it. So by the way, when you go to a funeral out of the cemetery, they put green carpet over the dirt that they've dug out of the grave. You know, we don't want to see that. And they put flowers all around and try. It's almost like we're trying to avoid reality. Isn't that interesting? But here's the Bible telling us it's fools that want to laugh and goof off all the time and play all the time. The wise heart is in the house of mourning. What a powerful passage. All right, that's all review. Vindication. Suffering serves the purpose of vindicating God. What am I talking about? Again, Job is the premier book on this suffering issue, is it not? Whenever God said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil." Now, what if Job, after God having kind of bragged about him that way to Satan, what if Job had thrown in the towel? Because God's saying, you can count on Job. He's a righteous man. So for Job to hang in there was to bear up under suffering was a vindication of God and God's claims about him. Allowing Job to be afflicted with God's way of was God's way of demonstrating that he was worthy, that he is worthy of our worship and devotion and obedience apart from anything he does for us. See, it's as if when people say, "Well, you know, I've gone through a horrible experience, so I'm leaving the church. I'm not coming back." If that's who your God is, I don't want to have anything to do with him. Well, then you're admitting that the reason why you have served God in the past is because what you got out of it. That's an impure motive. Why are we here today? Well, I like to sing. I just love to sing. I've had people tell me that. I make business contacts. I'm an insurance man. I've heard all kinds of, my parents are here and they kind of expect me to be here. All kinds of motives. The Bible teaches that we ought to want to worship God and love Him and bow before Him no matter what we're going through, because He's God. Every human being ought to render allegiance to God simply because He's God. Think about that. If suddenly you woke up one morning and your house was burned down, you've lost all of your money, you know, you end up sitting on a ash heap outside of town, a pauper in rags, you still ought to worship God because of who He is. He's the only being that is worthy of our worship. And He's so great. You know, that's the point that God makes to Job beginning in chapter 38 when Job's demanding, "What's going on here? I need an explanation." God said, "No, you don't. And I sure don't have to explain anything to you." And He starts dazzling him with one wonder of the universe after another, with questions. "Do you understand this? Were you there when this happened? Do you know how this functions?" And you know, a few of those, science has progressed to the point where we kind of have some understanding of it, but so much we still don't. Why was he throwing all that at him? To try to broaden his awareness that this is the transcendent, eternal, infinite governor of the universe. Now, he doesn't owe you anything, and you ought to be flat on your face in front of him. Notice that whole perspective. When you have that perspective and you're just wanting to bow before God, you kind of forget about yourself and all your aches and pains. Because all of our attention ought to be on that incredible being who is beyond our comprehension and who has lowered himself to make it possible for us to be accepted by him and live with him eternally. Come on, what else do we want? Well, most people say, well, I want some money in my pocket, a nice car, and I want this, this, and this, and that. Well, this ought to be enough. The Lord said to Satan, "You consider my servant Job, just none like him on earth." Look at this allusion to integrity. This is the second occasion where God spoke with Satan. And still he holds fast to his integrity. His wife said to him, "Why are you still holding on to your integrity?" Eliphaz said to him, "Is not your reverence, your confidence in the integrity of your ways, your hope?" In other words, Job's continued commitment to the one true God of those spiritual principles was really the thing that mattered. And so he said, "I don't care what happens to me, when I go down in death, I'm still going to hold on to my integrity." That's a great attitude for Christians to have. Hold on to our integrity. Well, how do you do that? Well, you understand who God is. Who God is. Who else do we want to please and ultimately be with? And then finally, this concept of verification. What do I mean by that? Well, in Job chapter 23, remember now there's this repeated cycles of Job talking to God, talking to his friends, and then one of his friends will speak up, and then you'll go back to Job, and it just keeps doing this. And here is the section where he's kind of talking out loud to himself, I guess. His friends are over there listening, but he's not directly addressing them. He says, "Even today, my complaint is bitter. My hand is listless because of my groaning." Remember, he's in intense pain. He has a disease that some medical authorities suggest was probably elephantiasis, a type of leprosy that literally eats away at the body. 24/7, you can't get any relief. There's constant searing pain. And all through the book, he gives little medical descriptions like worms in his flesh and things along that line. He's in just intense, agonizing, constant pain for months, the text indicates. I don't know how much beyond that, but at least 2 months, because the plural of the term is used. And so he's just in agony, and he's just restless. He can't sleep. He's emaciated. He's lost a lot of weight. He has a serious illness. He says, "Oh, that I knew where I might find him." See, he keeps wanting God. Do you feel that way too? No matter how confident you are God exists, you've never actually seen him. You've never actually heard him. There's kind of a disconnect there. Physically, our spirits can know God exists. I'm confident that he does. But he's never actually manifested himself to me literally. And that's the way Job was. We think a lot of these people throughout the Bible were just talking to God every day. That's not true. Not even Abraham. There were like years and years, 2 or 3 decades go by before God would have any communication with Abraham. And we're thinking that they were somehow favored in that. But there was really not that much contact that God gave directly. And he didn't give Job one lick until late in the game. He finally broke the silence, spoke out of a whirlwind. "Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments." You know, in other words, say, "God, let me explain to you why this really isn't fair that I'm having to go through this in life." You ever feel that way? And I can give you the reasons. You know, I go to church every Sunday. You know I do. I put money in the collection plate. See all the arguments that we would arrange that we think would say, therefore, I really don't deserve to have to go through this. If people are going to have to suffer, let it be these pagan evil people that won't even go to church on Sunday morning. before it's over with, you remember what Job says about that. Man, I wish I'd put my hand over my mouth from the very beginning. I would present my case, fill my mouth with arguments. I would know the words that he would answer me. I would learn. I want to find out what God has against me and understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me with his great power? That, you know, God's so awesome and overwhelming. Would he just overwhelm me? No. But he would take note of me. There the upright could reason with him, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. See, he thinks that he's being judged by God. That was a misinterpretation of what was happening. Isn't it fascinating that from Job chapter 1 all the way to 42, we are told Satan's behind this. He was behind it. God didn't just decide one day, oh, I think I'm going to afflict Job and see how he does. No. Satan came and incited that. And God never tells Job that. Okay, then you and I don't need to know the source of our suffering. It really doesn't matter. It shouldn't alter our handling of it, our facing of it. Look, I go forward, he's not there. Backward, I can't perceive him. When he works on the left hand, I can't behold him. When he turns to the right hand, I can't see him. So all this stuff's going on in his life, and he's looking for God. He's grasping for some indication from God as to how to make sense of this. Why is this happening to me? Now look at this statement that he makes. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. Now you might think that that's the one that the reason that we looked at earlier, where Job is being tested in the sense of perfected, matured, so hardship was designed to improve and correct him. But that's not what he's talking about here. Look how he says, my foot has held fast to his steps. I've kept his way and not turned aside. I've not departed from the commandments of his lips. In fact, I've treasured his words more than my food. So it's not that Job's being disciplined so that he will be better. That's not the cause and the reason for the suffering. This is a reference to the procedures that have been used in metallurgy. In ancient times, we no longer use these today, but you know, if that old prospector went out there in the Superstition Mountains of Arizona and dug in a gold mine and found ore, you know, they didn't find, it would be extremely rare for you to dig in the dirt and find just a solid gold nugget. Now what you're going to find is rock with streaks and bits of gold in it. And this ore would have different levels of purity or percentage of metal. Well, how do you determine what kind of a strike you have made? How good is this strike? Well, they would use a touchstone, which was a fine-grained dark stone used to test the fineness of gold. That is, they would take the ore when it was brought into the assayer, is that what he was called? And they would rub that ore on that touchstone. And depending upon the coloration and so forth, that would tell the assayer what kind of a strike you had made. How good is this gold? So I understand Job here to be saying that all of this hardship and suffering that I'm going through is God rubbing me on this stone. But I'm confident when he's finished, I'm going to be shown to be gold. I don't think he's bragging. I think he's saying, all through the book he says, I'm perfectly willing to confess my sins. That's what the three friends keep telling him. Own up to it. Come on, we know you're a big sinner. We haven't seen any evidence. It's true. You've really done well. But you must have all kinds of secret sins. And Job says, I'm not aware of it. Unless we're talking about the sins of my youth, he says. But you remember the section, for example, where he says, you show me, for example, one poor person that's not wearing one of my sheepskins. I help the poor. I take care of people. I don't lust after women. I don't worship the stars. I mean, he goes through a long list of things that shows he's a righteous man. Well, we knew he was. God said he was at the beginning. So he's perplexed. Why is this happening to me? And that's the only reason why God gets a little rough with him, because it's like his attitude is like, you know, I need an explanation why this is happening. And God's saying, whoa, 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 wait a minute. God doesn't have to explain anything to us. Well, why would we think that we deserve that? Because clearly, we have all earned, we all deserve to go to hell, every one of us, many times over. The wages of sin is death. We all deserve it. We deserve to be paid the wages we've earned. So you see, anything that God does to throw out a little lifeline or to pay us any attention, we don't deserve, and it only is a reflection of his great goodness and love. So when you and I cop an attitude and say, now wait a minute here, I think God should explain this to me, and I don't think that this should befall me. See, that's a prideful attitude. That's as close as I can see that Job gets to sin. And I don't know that he ever actually crossed the line. Because at the very end, God, after he chastises him a little bit, he turns to the friends and says, you better get him to pray for you. Because he's good with God. So, do you understand that one purpose of suffering in the world is for God to be vindicated, to show that you are worthy of going through the suffering? God can count on you to not let Satan gloat. So look at this statement. Hardship and suffering in your life may well be an indication that God approves of you. You know, do you want to be disciplined by God to make you better? Yeah. Would you like for God to put you through suffering because he thinks you're okay the way you are? Yeah. I don't know that there's very many people like Job. I think Job must have been extremely unusual in the whole long scheme of human history. Here's another passage that makes that point. This is Paul. He's saying, you know, when you're singled out by God to be an apostle and you're given his words to record for all history, it's pretty easy to get to thinking you're somebody. So lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me. And of course, the sages of the ages have discussed what that is. We talked some about this yesterday, didn't we? I won't repeat what I said, some commentators say. But he calls it a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. See, you and I don't want to see things that happen to us that are extremely unpleasant as something we desperately need to keep our attitudes right so that we can be saved. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times, but each time he said, my grace is sufficient for you. You remember we talked, did we not, yesterday about that concept. What's he saying? He's saying, Paul, I accept you. I count you saved. If you were to die at this moment, you're going to heaven. Now, is that not enough for you? You're wanting to go to heaven and not have any suffering in life? No pain? Come on, if you knew that God loved you and right at this moment accepts you, would you not be willing to go through anything in your life that you've got to go through? Because you know, when we come to the end, I know the outcome. I know the outcome. That's got to be extremely comforting to all of us. So, when we've gone through the hardship and the temptation and the testing, and when we've been proved, we'll receive the crown of life that the Lord promises to those who love him. All right, so there are 5 sub-causes of suffering under the umbrella cause that we're here in this world to prepare for eternity, so we have to go through whatever life deals out to us. Look at this statement that was made by Brother Warren in his great book, Have Atheists Proved There Is No God? Look at this. This is such a great statement. The stakes in eternity, and we're talking about heaven, and the counter possibility, unending conscious pain. Are these not high stakes? The stakes in eternity are of such magnitude as to render all pain and suffering in this life of no ultimate negative significance. See, the atheist doesn't understand that. They think, man, this is cut and dried. There's pain and suffering. There can't be a God. If he is, he's evil. No, you don't understand. You're putting too much weight down on pain and suffering as if that's the ultimate evil in the world. It's not even evil. The only evil in the world is violation of God's will. It's not evil for you to experience pain. That's human philosophy. How would you know to keep your hand away from a fire if you didn't feel the heat of that fire as you approach it? And there are many such examples. Pain's not inherently evil. It's unpleasant, but it's not evil. So their whole scheme of defining things, if I experience pain, that's evil. So good is the absence of pain. And off they go in all these wacky ideas. The Bible lays this out for us clearly. The only evil, the only moral evil in the world is when you violate God's will. 1 John 4:3. So, evil does not exist on the physical plane. It's a spiritual thing. It manifests itself, you see, in physical actions. But by looking at this, we understand you got to put pain and suffering in its place and not... I realize that pain hurts. And when you're going through it, it's easy to talk about, it's easy for you to say pain's not that big a thing because you're not going through it like I am. I understand all of that. So you just have to put your mind over your body. You know, Romans 8 says ultimately, you must not live your life based upon your flesh. I mean, you're in the flesh, but the gospel will inform your mind, your spirit, and then your spirit can bring your body and your fleshly appetites under control where you can see them with the proper perspective. So yes, the physical body is going to wreak all kinds of havoc on our spirits. Isn't that something, how God hardwired our spirits into a physical body? Maybe he'll explain that to us in eternity. So your spirit hurts when your body feels pain. Not interesting. But the fact of the matter is, that is the body. And you can transcend that with your mind by staying focused on the ultimate stakes. That overshadows anything that you and I have to go through. Now, the way that was put by Paul in Romans is the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared. He said, well, yeah, they are. Do you know how much I've been hurting? Well, all I can do is tell you that God says the suffering you're going through is not worthy to be compared with the things that are going to be revealed to us in the eternal state. We will look back at this brief life and we'll see it then. We'll say, oh, okay, I see it now. Boy, I sure thought at the time it was unending. But now I can see it was for a brief time in light of eternity. That's designed to give us encouragement and determination to hold on. Paul even said our light affliction. Say, do you want to describe it that way? If you're in the middle of pain and suffering, that's not how you describe it. But that's how God describes it. We've got to get our perspective from him. Our light affliction, which is but for a moment. Well, wait now. Are you talking about one split second? Or are you talking about, you know, I've been enduring this for 10 years. Remember the woman that we mentioned who was stooped over, bent over for what, 17, 18 years? You're calling that a moment? That's what it's called in Scripture. The only way for you and me to know that that's true is because God told us that. And that then helps us to adjust our perspective where we can see that. This is not perpetual. It will end. Even if we have to endure it for a period of years. And in fact, it's working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. And then Hebrews 11. Remember, Moses had the opportunity to experience great pleasure. You know, we should never tell our children that sin is not pleasurable. It is. Drugs or illicit sex or whatever. In fact, when you tell children that, they say, well, why should I listen to anything else you say? Because I know that's not true. The Bible says it's true. But they're temporary. They're passing. They don't last. And they'll bring all kinds of heartache and negative consequences into your life. And so, what's your other choice? Affliction? Suffering? And isn't it incredible that Moses consciously chose that, according to this text? Because why? We got greater riches coming down the pike. A reward in heaven with God. Even if you could achieve everything in this world physically that you would want to achieve and gain the whole world, what good is it if you lose the spiritual side of this thing? There's the biblical perspective that we have to keep ever before us. James 5, look at the prophets. They're a great example of suffering and patience for all of us. We count them blessed to who have endured. We heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord. Isn't that incredible? You look at all that Job went through in that agony. And yet, here's the conclusion. The Lord is really compassionate and merciful. He really is. Of course, the outcome was absolutely incredible. In fact, one of his daughters, do you remember there in the last chapter, one of his daughters became a world-renowned businesswoman, a pancake magnate. Her name was Jemima. I got to add a little suffering to the lesson, you know, just to kind of make. We ought to be like the farmer whose mule fell into a pit. You know, that animal is so big, there's no way to get it out. He couldn't get it out. So rather than let it gradually starve and die, he thought humanely, go ahead and kill it. So he began shoveling dirt in this pit, you know, to just go ahead and bury the poor thing, let him suffocate, and that'd be the end of it. Well, every time a shovel of dirt would come down on his mule's back, he'd shake it off and stomp on it. And he just kept doing that until, and finally there was enough dirt that it raised him up and he just stepped out, you know. Well, that's what you and I need to do. Satan's trying to bury us. Shake it off. When you face hardship and suffering, shake it off and be determined to go forward. God loves us. He will be with us through all adversity that we have to face. We can and must live faithful. See, there's never an excuse. It's so easy for us to think, well, but my circumstances are unique and they're peculiar. I am truly justified in backing away from the church and becoming unfaithful. And, you know, I'll get back to church when I finally can cope with all of this. That's not justifiable. We can and we must live faithful, even in the face of pain, suffering, and hardship. Been so kind to listen today. May God bless all of us with the fortitude in life to bear up under whatever may come our way, no matter what. Thank you. God bless you.